To kick off this session, we'll have three speakers today. Our first one will be Noman Azanamazan. He is a professional engineer and a doctorate with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. So Noman provides scientific support to Superfund and RCRA sites in the U.S. EPA Region 4. He's a civil and environmental engineer with over 20 years of experience in subsurface slope and solute transport modeling, site characterization, groundwater remediation, modeling software development. Let me just make a reminder to folks to not put us on, please be sure if you're on the phone line, don't put that phone line on hold. And make sure that your audio on your computer is muted if you are listening on the phone line, or else we may have some additional audio coming through. Okay. Okay. So Noman, Dr. Azanamazan has developed or co-authored several modeling software projects or packages for the U.S. EPA Center for Subsurface Modeling Support in Ada, Oklahoma. Dr. Azanamazan has performed technical review of groundwater modeling software packages and site-specific applications of groundwater models in numerous EPA-regulated Superfund and RCRA sites. Noman, if you're ready to go, I'll have you bring yourself off of mute, and we will get started.
All right, thank you, Cindy. Can you hear me?
Okay, I can hear. I think I can hear you. Noman, you there?
Yes.
Okay, you're good. Go for it.
All right, thank you. Again, my name is Noman Azanamazan, and I work for Region 4. Good afternoon, everybody from East Coast in Atlanta. I'll talk about basic settings for building a better model. So the perspective is to help you review groundwater models and also to look at how you would be able to make a reasonably good model with the modeling tools we have or we use regularly. So my presentation outline is I'll touch some basis on important issues for setting up a groundwater model, and then the basic checks you do as a model reviewer or a modeler yourself, talk about how our uncertainty analysis has been done and how it could be more useful if it's done in a recommended way that I feel like is more useful. And finally, we'll have a overall discussion on whether and how important is modeling framework for the community or for the scientists. So before modeling, you actually need to ask yourself, is modeling is necessary? That's the last bullet point on my slide here, but I just bring it up to the front because oftentimes you can make a decision without going through a modeling exercise. So I feel like you should ask yourself, is the modeling exercise necessary or at what extent it is necessary? So first thing you need to look at even before modeling is what is the conceptual site model? And every Superfund site or RCRA site has a conceptual site model. And it's important to look at it because you need to find out what kind of modeling package is important. For example, if you have a chlorinated solvent, you need to pick up or use RT3D instead of MT3D or MT3DMS because you want to have the chain reaction, in a first order chain reaction in your transport model. As far as the flow model is most commonly done is Modflow, so I'm not going to talk about that in detail. But as far as transport model, you have the option of selecting either MT3D MS or MT3D or RT3D. So which one is most important would be important for you to pick up from the conceptual model. The second part is next you look at the digital elevation model. Do you have a plan view of the whole model? Do you have the lithologic data? To what extent you could interpret that in your model? And the hydrogeologic and physical condition you have in the site, is it a porous system or a fracture system? Oftentimes you do model as a porous system, but you may have a fracture system that you're trying to model in a porous media. So you have to pay attention to that kind of detail. Is how good is your porous media model structure has to be to fit a fractured rock system. So, and there are models for fractured rock system as well. But again, I'm talking about MT3D, MS, and Modflow, which are basically Modflow is based on porous media system. And what is the modeling objective? What are you trying to achieve? Is it a pumpage system you're trying to model, or is it a you want to project how far your cleanup objective will be, how long will it take for your remediation, or what objective you are trying to achieve through modeling. And the most important part is how much data you have. Do you have enough data, or do you see data gaps that you need to address first before you go for modeling? Or if you want to do a modeling to find the data gaps, that's another way of looking at also. And when you talk about is modeling necessary, you're talking about a numerical model. So there are very good analytical models also which assumes a uniform directional of groundwater flow and three-dimensional dispersion, first-order decay rate, and chain reaction also. There are models like biochlor, remchlor, remfuel available that you can do a decent job, maybe a screening level or maybe even better than screening level job with those analytical models. And you have to ask yourself, is that model enough for your system, or do you really need a three-dimensional flow system where the groundwater is actually flowing in a multiple direction? For example, if you have a pump-entry system, I would not recommend an analytical model, but for a natural system, you might be able to do a decent job with analytical models as well. To clear the right area. So before you go for modeling, now you're ready to do modeling, what do you need to look at? The first thing is, are you going to build a steady state model or a transient model? Most cases, it's a steady state model that you build. So you have to have the data set that you are going to use for calibrating the model. And you need to look at what data sets you are going to use for calibration and what you leave for your validation purpose. So it's always a good idea to leave your validation data set separate from your calibration data set. And then if you are looking at a pump entry system or a system that you'll be pumping at some point, you'll think about how much data is there available for a transient flow calibration, because there are parameters like storage coefficient you cannot calibrate from a steady state model. So you need a transient model or transient data set from a pump and treat study or some other avenue that you would like to use for calibrating those parameters for your model. Next is to find what target wells you want to actually calibrate. So if you are looking at a source area or nearby source area or an area that is very important that you're trying to limit your migration to, you want to use those wells that are covering the area that you are paying attention to should be your target wells. If you are looking at a boundary that you are trying to calibrate in the model, so you can pick up some wells that should help you to calibrate the boundary values, or at least check whether your boundary values are good or not. So you have to pick up the target wells. For transport model, if the source is decaying or not, is a good question for you to look at first. And then partitioning coefficient is an important parameter for your transport model. Do you have any estimation of or any data set that you can use for your partitioning coefficient estimation? Is biodegradation happening? If it does, do you see any daughter product from your biodegradation? And is there any estimation available for your biodegradation rate? What is the first order decay rate for biodegradation? Not based on the model results. You haven't done model yet. But if you have some other analytical way to find the degradation rate or from a literature research, you need to get all those numbers in your hand so that you can have an idea what kind of calibration number you would expect from your model. And finally, for a transport model, obviously, what kind of package you would need. So again, if you need a chain reaction, first order chain reaction, then you'd go with RDCD. If you have multiple COCs that are not reactive to each other, MT3DMS is good enough. Now, at the beginning of modeling, model setup, first thing you look at is how big your model domain should be. It should be much, much bigger than the area that you are interested in. For example, in the figure on the right, you can see the all the colored area in the bottom is where all the things are happening, but you're looking at a much broader area that you are actually trying to model. So rule of thumb is to get about 10 times or more bigger model domain than the modeling area that you were interested about. Because you don't want the boundaries to influence too much on your modeling simulations. That's the purpose of having a larger model domain. The lithology, do you have enough lithologic data? Because when you're doing model layers, you need to know where the lithology changes from, you know, from the water table to the confining units and all those elevations you need to have to draw those layers as accurate as possible. So if you have more holes, more boreholes, more lithologic information, you can put those in your model layer setup. Boundary conditions. Do you know the boundary conditions very well? Is it a large river or a stream or is there any other type of boundary that you would like to have, you know, covered in your domain? So naturally, people would like to go with natural boundaries all around the model domain to actually have a handle on the boundaries in the periphery of the modeling domain. And one rule of thumb is you don't use a constant head boundary just close to your facility, because if you are putting an extraction well in future, that constant head boundary will impact your results significantly. And again, the calibration target of all the wells you set up as a target wells, are those good enough for your calibration target? So what I recommend is to set up your calibration targets within the model domain, and then also set a subset of calibration targets within the key areas that you are trying to do your remediation work, for example. Next is flow model calibration. Obviously, if you have more data, then your calibration would be useful. And you usually have a lot more data for flow model calibration, because all you need, most of the data you need is your water elevation data, and then having pump test and flux test data to calibrate your hydraulic conductivity is also important. So you have a lot more data available for flow model calibration compared with a solid transport model, and you have a lot less parameter also for flow model calibration versus a transport model calibration. So when you are talking about a transport model, before even you go for transport model, your first step is to look at how good you can calibrate the flow model. The better the flow model, the calibration model, the transport model will actually feed from that. So if your flow model is not good, your transport model calibration will be even worse. So that's why you have to put a lot more energy on your flow model calibration. And that's my recommendation, of course. And then when you go calibration, you can look at manual versus automated calibration. By saying automated calibration, the most commonly used tool is the PEST calibration. The PEST model is nothing but an inverse modeling tool that calibrates the model parameter based on the given result. So what PEST does is you have to put some pilot points, which are some artificial points all along the model domain, and you put range of values for each parameter in that in those pilot points. So as you can see on the figure on the right, all these black dots here are the pilot points. Okay, and in here though, the bigger circles are the known slug and pump test data in the model. Okay, so when you do a PEST calibration, you set up a number of unknown or artificial pilot points that will guide the model to a calibration point. And you have to remember, model calibration is not a unique solution. It could be calibrated at a totally different number when you do it at a different setup, and you still get the same statistical calibration. So it's not a unique solution. So PEST will try to find the best solution of all the condition you actually allowed it to move. So it's important that what initial value you set up in PEST. So if you set up an initial head or initial hydraulic conductivity value that are way off from the actual value, then it'll gradually go towards that point, and it may not reach to the actual value before it meets the calibration criteria. So your initial values that you put in each of the PEST pilot points is going to be sensitive to your calibration, and you could be totally wrong if your initial values are not as good as your the actual value. So what I recommend is to start with manual calibration, because when you're starting with PEST, you don't know how the model is behaving. You just set up a number. What the consultants do is they put every parameter with a wide range of hydraulic conductivity values in the order of magnitude, 3-4 order of magnitude range for hydraulic conductivities, and then it let the PEST run and try to find its solution. And I think that's the method that would lead you to a number that you have no idea or no way to validate. So in my view, I recommend that you always start with a manual calibration, and once you get a good handle on the model, you set up a very tight range for each model parameters before you run your PEST calibration to improve or fine-tune your flow model. So in this figure on the right side, you can see these are the pilot points. Are still showing you bullseyes around it. Okay, so obviously these pilot points is actually guiding this model to have a different hydraulic conductivity compared to the rest of the area surrounding it. So what is the reason for that kind of calibration? You don't have any actual data. All the actual data are here and here. So why is this point showing such a bullseye? In my view, it's probably an error generated from the pilot point value. So you can take it one way that, okay, I need to go in that location and get some pump test or slug test data to verify if this hydraulic conductivity is good or not, and this location also. So this is a good example of showing how a pilot point can can actually guide your model to a direction that is questionable. Okay? So that's a good example of a pilot point or automated calibration by PEF versus a manual and automated calibration. Now, statistically, what is the criteria that people use for flow model calibration? Generally, the industry standard is to have a normalized root mean square error value of less than or equal 10%. There's an industry norm, I would say. It's not a written standard or anywhere any guidelines or anything, but that's the common practice. So what is normalized root mean square error? It is actually the root mean square divided by the range of hydraulic range of observed head. The range of observed head is where this number could be manipulated. By saying manipulated, I wanted to clarify this, because if you have a really large domain, obviously your range of observed head value would be large. And when you are dividing the root mean square with a large head range, your statistical criteria will look good. So that's why I said it can manipulate this number by getting a large domain and getting a large observed head range, and your normalized root mean square will fall within 10% easily, most likely. So the goal is to, when you're reviewing a model or you're doing a model, goal is to keep the normalized root mean square error to about 5% in not the model domain. I would say in the model area that you are interested about. For example, in the previous figure I was showing, the area where everything is happening, where you have the most well network of your model, that's where you want to achieve a NRMSE value of 5% or close to 5%. If you reach 5% for the entire model domain, that's good. But you want to focus on the key interest area where you would like to get a better calibration. So by tightening the NRMSE value within that zone to between 5 and 10% will be a good way to see where the model is failing, and you can now go and manually adjust your model to get back to your as close calibration as possible. All right? Like I said, I don't want to recommend you to have a, site-wide NRMSE of less than 10% is the only criteria for your calibration. And also, you need to look at how the qualitative matchup between observed and calibrated potentiometric surfaces. So if you have drawn by kriging your potentiometric surfaces, and how that match with your calibrated model, just to see a qualitative way of looking, and not just the statistical way, you look at the qualitative calibration as well when you call it a calibrated model. Following calibration comes the validation part. So in my view, calibration and validation is like an iterative process. You do calibration, and then you go do a validation of the data. If the validation fails, you come back to calibration and try to do better the calibration, and you go back and do validation again. So it's like a cycle of thing that cycle of steps that you do one after another. One thing I missed here for calibration is the residual distribution map. You also need to look at the residual distribution map before you say the model is well calibrated, because you can statistically have a good NRMSE number, but you may have a bias in your residual error. For example, in this same model, if you look at this area on the top, you have all the negative residual errors, and you look at the bottom, you have all the positive residual errors. What it means that the gradient between the two circular zones would be a lot more biased to the higher or lower gradient than what actually it is. You'd like to have a well-distributed positive and negative, like in these areas of your, you know, so you want to have a well-distributed positive and negative residual errors in throughout the domain, not positive on one side only and negative on the other side only. That can create a, you know, error in your hydraulic gradient estimation. So that's the calibration. And like I said, the calibration and validation is an iterative process. The last comment I have here is validation is not a popular thing among consultants. And if you don't ask for a validation effort, they will probably not do it. So make sure you say, okay, I want model calibrated and validated before you actually, before the modeling work is done. That's very common, that validation kind of left behind, because this is always part of the calibration only. Believe me, the consultants would try to run everything in tests and give you a calibrated model, and will not try any manual way of calibration or validation at all if you're not asking for it. And then sensitivity or uncertainty analysis is very important. That's also not very popular among consultants. You have to ask for it. Then I want the model sensitivity analysis. By saying sensitivity analysis, you want actually to look at the parameter sensitivity, how the model parameters change could affect your result. But most commonly what you get if you are not communicating at the very beginning what you want, you'll most likely get a comparison of the root mean square value between the calibrated and the simulated model for sensitivity analysis. It's just a big number, and you'll say, oh, okay, we have the RMSD value change 5% with the change of parameters of by whatever percent. Doesn't tell much as far as I'm concerned. I'm sitting here making a decision whether my pump and treat system is going to be enough to contain the flume, or my estimate for time to reach the cleanup goal is good. It doesn't give you that sensitivity. So what I expect from a model sensitivity analysis is my remedial option is protective with the sensitivity of the parameter. So if it's a containment system, if I change hydraulic conductivity by 10% or 50% or 100%, is it going to be still contained? That's what I'm interested about. So this is what you would ask for a sensitivity analysis, but oftentimes you not get that unless you specifically mention that to the modeler or to the consultant. So that's the statement I said, model uncertainty as it relates to the modeling objective, and only identify the gap that or data gap that you have to find to address the uncertainty. That's the objective of doing the uncertainty analysis, not just comparing the two statistical numbers from your sensitivity analysis. And next, solid transport model is a big part. It has a lot more parameters to be calibrated for transport model, so it obviously will have more uncertainty involved in it. I just wanted to highlight three common questionable practices that is done in transport model. Number one is the retardation factor. Usually, there is a favor to put a high retardation factor in your model. Sources. Instead of trying to use a constant concentration or a decaying concentration source, you put an initial source concentration, and then it goes away very quickly. That's another option. And then the biodegradation half-life. So those are the three areas I'll touch in the next few slides. First, the retardation factor. One way to get it is to do a batch or a column test. So when you do a batch test, you would end up with a much higher retardation or partitioning coefficient, because particles will be broken down. It will be more surface area for particles to grab on the organic contaminants, and that's why you end up with a higher KD for a batch test. Okay, so a higher KD will give you a higher retardation factor. On the other hand, if you do if you do a column test, you would run it through a column of undisturbed soil sample. I think that's a better way to calibrate your model KD based on a column test than going through a batch test. And another way you can also estimate KD is by estimating FOC, fraction organic content, and multiplying that with KOC value to find your KD. Oftentimes what commonly is done is you get the FOC value from a contaminated soil sample. So when you get a sample from a contaminated area, then you'll obviously get more organic content because your contaminated COC is contributing to the organic content estimation as well. So you should be actually looking at a background sample to get your FOC number if you are going through this method of calculating KD based on FOC and KOC. Again, my recommendation is to go with column test if possible, and then use that number in your transport model calibration. And also, the final point is particle tracking modeling. I would do particle tracking modeling even before I do the transport model calibration, which will show me which direction groundwater is flowing at the speed of water movement. The instantaneous source issue is what oftentimes sources are assumed in a model is as a instantaneous source. What it means at time zero, you have a concentration of whatever concentration you have at present, and time 0.1, that concentration drops to zero. So what it is, you have a dissolved concentration only, and it will decay or get absorbed in the soil, and you see the concentration goes away very quickly. For example, in the figures in the bottom, you see from here, it goes down in a few years. All this concentration is dropping so sharply by doing nothing. Okay, so what it is because you took an initial concentration here, within few years, you see all those mass is going to get extracted by this extraction well, EW2. And nothing is left at the end of 10 years. So it's here, this one is staying a little longer, but the other two goes away pretty quickly. And this is, when you see this kind of reaction or this kind of, unexpectedly good result, you question yourself how the source concentration was assumed in the model. So if you dig into, in this case, it was used as the initial concentration versus a constant concentration source. Sometimes people use a high KD to simulate back diffusion, and that in my view is a questionable practice because high KD will assure everything is staying with the soil, and it will release little bit of concentration in the groundwater for a long time, but most of the mass will stay in the soil. You'll never see it in the water. So as the plume move away, the soil is contaminated according to the model, but groundwater is not. So I think it's a questionable practice. And of course, you need to do the historic matching of the source concentration. So you set up a set of target wells, and you want to see, okay, is the model showing the historic matchup of the source concentration at the downgradient well next to the source before we call it a calibrated source concentration. So you have to look at that very closely. Again, I'm trying to point out some of the common mistakes or common ways of, the modeling mistakes could be when you are reviewing a model for your site. The third point on solid transport model is the biodegradation rate. Oftentimes you see that you look at a trend plot and you get the decay rate from the trend plot, and that is used as a biodegradation rate. Biodegradation rate is not the decay rate. Decay rate involves everything. All the naturally attenuating processes are a reason for the decay rate. For example, sorption, diffusion, biodegradation, if any, all those will be accounted into a well-by-well trend plot. So if you use that value in your model as a biodegradation rate, you'll be always overestimating the biodegradation. So make sure that biodegradation rate is much less than the decay rate. And for example, for biodegradation to happen, what you see at most of the time is you have a fixed rate for the entire plume, while biodegradation is happening in the in certain pockets. So you have to make sure that the daughter products are present in areas where you have the biodegradation rate applied in your model. You can discretize the biodegradation rate. You can set up biodegradation rate in different zone of the model domain at a different rate. So you need you before you accept that this is going to be a flat rate for the entire area or two different rates for source and the plume, you need to really pay attention that, okay, is it really just two rates, or is it is there a some area where biodegradation is not happening? Because if biodegradation process is an anaerobic process, it may not be anaerobic in the entire plume. It could be only a limited area where the anaerobic degradation is happening. So you pay attention to that as well by looking at the daughter product in those areas where you are applying the biodegradation rate. And in this figure, I want to show you this is all these lines are an order of magnitude. So this is the lowest order of magnitude, and blue is the highest order of magnitude. So two order of magnitude difference between the between the yellow and the blue line. As you see, if it's under after 50 years, which is about four half-lives that was used in this model, so within four half-lives, you're supposed to get an order of magnitude drop in your concentration by biodegradation alone. So it's a very slow-moving plume, but what you can see is, look at monitoring well, 24T was on orange line. Now 24T is on a yellow line. So one order of magnitude dropped in 50 years at that well, and you can tell that only by using a 13-year half-life, that order of magnitude drop is possible. So irrespective of anything happening other than biodegradation is enough for this scenario. So that practice has to be, you know, kind of questionable here, because only biodegradation is happening on the plume that is sitting and not moving at all the way it was modeled in here. Solution with a question mark is very critical, because I think this is the number one point is the most important part. As a reviewer or as the person who is involved in a modeling, you should get involved very early, and you should lay out what you expect from your modeling work, and you have to get it at the beginning of your modeling job, not after the consultant has done the model calibration and bring it to you. You could find all those questions, but oftentimes all the funding is exhausted by the time you set up, you know, you recommend to do something different, and it doesn't go through of any modification or adjustment of the model because of the time and funding both has been used up by then. So I think it's very important that you get involved very early in the process, and you set up everything, and you get involved throughout the process as well to get a better solution to your model calibration and modeling objective. So how you do it, you discuss the modeling framework and work plan in the beginning, specify the modeling needs that you'd expect from the modeler, or from, if you're doing yourself, from yourself, what kind of framework you're going to use for your model. As far as modeling framework, we don't have any modeling guideline per se that is very specifically telling this is what you can do and this is what you cannot do or should not do. So it's very vast. Modeling world is very vast. It's very hard to cover, and I understand why we don't have any specific guideline for modeling purpose. But I think a small or limited scope framework is important, or a checklist, whatever we name it, is important for us to get a better model as a regulator, get a better model, or as a consultant to build a better model, or as a modeler to do a better job, an acceptable job for you. So again, this is kind of a question that where we stand, is it really necessary? And we are, as a, in the agency, we're talking about it. Interagency, we're also talking about it. Do we need a framework that we can actually build with a very simple guideline kind of framework? We don't want to tie everybody into a very limited scope, because again, modeling world is a vast world. You cannot actually cover everything in a set of guidelines, and that's probably why we don't have any guidelines at this so far in groundwater modeling. I think that's it. That's all for my presentation. I'm open for questions and comments.
Thank you, Noman. I think we have just time for one question. If there are more coming in, we'll try and get to those later on. But going back to your first point in the summary there, this kind of ties in with it. So we had a participant mention that calibration, validation, and sensitivity analysis information are essential to a model, but these tend to often be eliminated due to the time, effort, or cost involved. So how do you convince a client or a stakeholder that these pieces are worthwhile?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very, very common question, that how much time is allowed for modeling, is it enough time? So I think that's between the client and the regulator also, because if you are doing modeling and you want to get a decision point based on your model, you should be able to allow the time and money to get it done. So that's why I think there's a big push for going through PEST calibration, because you can do it in a shorter time. You just do a model for the sake of doing a model. You know it's not going to be as good as you'd be able to do it if you had time to do it manually as well as automated. So that's a big question as far, and we all have limited funding also and limited time as well. So again, it's how anxious or how important for you to do a modeling work, and how you can convince your client that it's important. And I think that's where maybe the modeling framework or modeling checklist that I'm talking about is going to help a consultant to negotiate that, hey, this is what we are expected to do, and this is what it would cost, and this much time it would take. So that's what I kind of feel like.
Great. Yeah, we're looking forward to seeing that checklist.
Hopefully.
All right. Thank you, Noman. And like I said, we'll come back to you if we have time at the end for some more questions. But now we're going to move on to our next speaker. So our second speaker today is Scott Morgan. He received both graduate and undergraduate degrees in geology from West Virginia University. And in the subsequent 30 years, where he spent more than 20 at AECOM and other companies related, he has contributed to hydrogeologic and groundwater monitoring, modeling investigations for both domestic and international, private and government clients. His primary focus areas are groundwater supply and site characterization within the Mid-Atlantic Coastal Plain and Piedmont physiographic provinces. Most recently, Mr. Morgan has been a contributor to investigations that utilize high-resolution analysis and innovative tools to evaluate intestine conditions and the natural recovery of groundwater at a site impacted by multi-component DNAPL. Okay, Scott, if you're ready, take away.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thanks.
Oh, okay. It didn't tell me I was off mute this time. Okay, well, hello. As stated, my name is Scott Morgan. I'm a hydrogeologist with AECOM, and on behalf of the Delaware Air Force Base team, it's my pleasure to be speaking with you today. Let's see if I can work these tools. Here we go. Our agenda will be as shown, a brief introduction, background, a talk of data evaluation, some source delineation and treatment, and then we'll go through a summary and the path forward. Over the next 15 or so slides, I'm going to present a case study for the role of models and other data evaluation techniques that we have used to support the evaluation and remediation of two former disposal areas at the Dover Air Force Base, and this has occurred over the past 30 years or so. So this has been going for quite a while. So this talk is not about the ins and outs of model design or creation. Moreover, it is of the use of a model or models as a tool to support decision-making, planning, and mostly confirming that our expectations and judgments remain valid. In some ways, this is analogous to what Noman was referring to as the validation or verification stage. So maybe that's what this talk is about, that the model's already been done, and now we're looking at the data to see how it's going. It is worth noting that Dover itself, as sites like Dover, are large, and there is a great many organizations, private, federal, and government, and academia, all working on various projects across the base. As such, there's a lot of collaboration and information sharing among the different groups. Thus, we were able to draw a lot of that information into our work at our two areas. So we had the benefits of those larger learnings and experiences to help our remedial action objectives establish and evaluate our remedial action objectives over time. So we certainly appreciate the opportunity to collaborate with others out there, such as the USGS. With that introduction, let's look at our study area. Dover Air Force Base is located in central Delaware, quite near the Delaware Bay estuary, as shown here on the figure. Whoops, let me grab my pointer. It's not letting me grab my pointer. Oh, maybe it is. Okay. It's located over here on the far left, central Delaware along the Delaware Bay estuary. Our sites in particular are located on the east, and on the east northeast perimeter of the Dover Air Force Base right out here, as shown in the figure in the middle. And then on the far right is a relatively recent aerial photo of the area, as shown. I don't have, unfortunately, a geologic cross-section to show everyone, but what I will tell you is this area is located in the Atlantic coastal plain, so the site here is underlain by a sequence of sands and gravels and clays. In particular, our superficial aquifer, which is our aquifer of interest, is about 25 to 30 feet thick of silty sands, which is then underlaid by a relatively impermeable aquitard. So we're looking at a single-layer system here. Groundwater is replenished through rainfall, which percolates downward to recharge the groundwater. And then groundwater flows to the northwest, mostly following the topographic gradients, similar to a pipe elm branch right there, as you see. Groundwater is also known to discharge the pipe elm branch. So it's a pretty straightforward system. It's not the most crazy system in the world. If you look to the lower right, those are our two areas of interest, WP-14 and LF-15. Both of these operated in 1950s and 1960s time frame. WP-14 was a liquid waste ditch or where things were disposed of, mostly solvents, greases from a local garage. And then LF-15, again, operated in the 50s and 60s, and that's where more solid wastes were disposed of, although they did get a little bit of waste waste from the garage as well. Sometime in the 60s, as is often the case, we're not too sure, they were closed, and they were left in place. They weren't remediated. They were just covered over with soil and grass and then left as they were. So that's the layout of our site and a little bit of the background on our two areas of interest. And I should say that, okay, well, I'll step forward, and we'll go from there. This is repeating just what I said, so if anyone wants to read these in the future, then there's the information for you. It is often useful to place our work in a timeline, and here's in a temporal context, excuse me, and here's our timeline that describes what events have gone on out there. The first sampling started in the 1996 timeframe and continued up through the 1993-94. In that sampling, they detected sites, constituents of concern in the groundwater at our area of interest, or downgrading from our areas of interest. And these are mostly TCE and PCE, and then their breakdown products, dichloroethene as well as vinyl chloride. It was about this time the USGS was doing some of their initial groundwater modeling and monitor natural attenuation studies at the site. Through these efforts, monitor natural attenuation was selected and incorporated into the Record of Decision, or ROD, in about the 1997 timeframe. So you can see the USGS was shown here in the bubbles above it. We're doing some of the initial work. And you can see that, you know, the various works, the monitor natural attenuation studying that was done. They've also done some mass flux analysis, and they've also done a flow model and, across the entire base. These look like one. These did not occur in a serial nature. They were published in a serial nature, but this work was very much a parallel activity with a lot of collaboration going on. So a lot of what was known from these studies were used to incorporate into the decision to use monitor natural attenuation for the ROD. So that's why some of these things might seem a little bit out of order. Now, something we should say about the ROD is the first thing about records of decision is that they're often time-gated or time-bound. We need to reach remedial action goals within a given time period. They're not forever decisions. Sometimes even when you're working with the regulator, they'll say, hey, we agree with you that you've got biotic reduction of your constituents out there. We agree with you that your CSIA shows an enrichment of a daughter product. How long? That's what we need to know is when will this be better? So that's often written into the ROD. In our case, I believe it was about 30 years is what our time horizon was for to reach our remedial action objectives. And I also want to add something about monitor natural attenuation. Monitor natural attenuation is not a do-nothing alternative. Acceptance of a monitor natural attenuation solutions mean you have done your homework to demonstrate that natural processes, biotic or abiotic, will reduce the mobility, toxicity, and or concentration of your site constituents to acceptable levels within the prescribed amount of time. So when you do that, you know, you're basically saying, hey, I've looked at this problem closely enough. I can see that these processes are happening. I can see that the daughter products are being evolved, and they are also decaying and being mineralized to their final products. So once you put this into the ROD, you're now, it even says monitored natural attenuation. You are obligated to monitor it. And this monitoring, again, falls into that validation and verification stages. Okay, you said it's going to happen. You've given us our predictions. You've given us this time horizon. Now go out there and make sure your judgments are correct. Make sure that your predictions are correct, that the models used to make those predictions are indeed accurate. And so that's what we're going to focus our study on. So starting from 1999 forward to about 2012, what you see there, each one of those blocks is about a year. In those years, we were collecting data, and so now what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about the story of evaluating that data, again, to assure that our modeling was correct and to assure that we are on track to make our remedial action objectives on time. Now, one way you can look at your data is plume maps, and that's what I'm showing on the screen right here. Now, plume maps in themselves is a form of modeling. Modeling doesn't have to be a super complicated computer algorithm. Modeling doesn't have to be an assemblage of resistors, capacitors, and wires as an analog, using electricity as an analog for groundwater flow. Anything that you use to organize your data into a thoughtful way can be construed as a model. And plume maps are models because someone who's created this plume map has sat down and said, thought to themselves and established for them to their personal satisfaction that the wells within that are being used have some covariance, some relative relation to the well next to it. There's a reason she's allowed to put two wells next to it, look at the concentration in each well and draw a conclusion. If these wells are 20 feet deep and the next well was 200 feet deep, that probably wouldn't be the case. So there is a thought process that you have to go through to make sure the data you're using in a plume map is actually data that is appropriate for using in a single plume map. These are not just scalar data with a mindless bubble wrapped around them. So using this type of analysis, we can come back and look at this. We have a data set from 1994. We have a data set from 2008. We have a data set from 2012. And again, we have established to our satisfaction that these data should be looked at together. And what we could see is have things over this 18-year period gotten better? We have a 30-year window. In 18 years, do we think we're on our way to making a remedial action objective? And I think the answer is kind of a resounding no. We don't really think this is going to happen here. Now, from 1994 to 2008, we have to be careful because this could, well control could be affecting the fact that we've got this extra long nose starting in 2008 that we didn't have in 1994. So wells have been put in, and maybe that nose was there all along, and now we're just seeing an artifact of the data set that was used in 94. Nonetheless, the point remains that if we want to get below 5 parts per billion for our constituents out there, and the outer ring of this line is the 5 part per billion ring, it doesn't look like we're going to make it. So right there, there's one strike against us using this method of data evaluation. The next form of data evaluation, and we're going to focus on the star in the middle of the plume here, or the mode of the plume, if you will, is the temporal analysis. And again, we're looking at a star. And what we can see here, and this goes from about, again, that 18-year period from 1994 to 2012. I had to do the math real fast in my head, make sure I didn't change my scales. We can see that the concentrations, aside from this rather curious drop in 2003, which I honestly can't, we don't have a clear explanation for. Was it raining? Was there something that happened out there? Are we seeing a major bit of mass move through that's then dropped off? But the point remains, this red line at the bottom shows our remedial action objective. And if we look at the later data here and fit a curve through that data, it's pretty apparent that we're not going to be dropping below our remedial action objective within our time period. And again, this putting your data on a temporal continuum, again, is a bit of a modeling exercise in of itself. It's not, again, super complex with partial differential equations, but it is you establishing that there's a temporal continuum here that these data should be viewed in such a way. And in this case, using that validation, again, we've got another check mark against us, we think, that our later data shows that we do not think we have a decreasing trend and we are not going to make a remedial action objective in time. And then finally, another way to look at the data, and I'll make sure I know where I left my arrow this time, is through numerical modeling. So what we did is, for this exercise, again, this talk isn't about making at all the ins and outs and criteria we used to make the model. So I'll tell you in general terms that we took everything we knew about this shallow sandy aquifer, the permeability, the bottom layers, the top elevations, the rainfall, the boundary conditions, and we created a multi-layer model. And then we populated that with, again, information that we knew about what controlled the migration of solute in this particular area. And for this case, it's a single solute model, so it's PCE, probably used MT3D or MT3DMS. I can't recall which off the top of my head. But we populated everything we knew about PCE transport with the degradation rates, some estimates for KD, some FOC, some adsorption characteristics. And then finally, we instantiated the model with the concentrations as measured in 1994, and that's what we see in this upper left. We also assumed that there was no source area because at the time what was handed to us is we did not believe there was any mass left in the source area. We thought we were looking at an ancient plume or a beheaded plume, if you will, from a ways back. And so with all this information loaded in, we then allowed the model to run forward in time. And indeed, what we see is we're right about this time frame, and then ultimately in 30 years, we're pretty darn close to our remedial action objectives. The model gives us a much more optimistic look at what the data look like out on the site. And so in that case, the model actually says, no, we think you can make your remedial action objectives on time. Now, that leads us to a problem. In the world of empirical modeling, in the world of modeling, empirical data is king. Doesn't matter what your model says is going to happen if, on the other hand, you have empirical data that says it's not happening. So this is a little bit what Noman was referring to as a validation or also a verification stage, that you have to kind of do this through time to make sure your initial models withstand the test of time. And in this case, our models, early models were used to some of these assessments, were obviously not living up to their billing. And we had to go back and revisit our assumptions, revisit our conceptual models, and say, okay, what is this model telling us? And I think that's one of the values that people should look at models for, is not as a yes or no, a binary tool, something that's going to tell you the answer is 42. that's not how models are, in my opinion, are most effective. They are a tool, they are a test bed that allow you to try your ideas out in a consistent manner on your desktop. And the more you play with them, the more you perturb the different inputs, you get to see how things move and then compare that to your empirical data. And then when you start seeing those differences, you can then start asking the questions, okay, why am I seeing that difference? What do I need to look at? What have I missed before when these well-founded equations are not representing what is actually happening in the real world? And in this case, as I'm probably hearing a lot of people say on the phone right now, is like, hey, did you go in their minds right now in the talk saying, hey, did you go back to your source area and make sure your assumption that you didn't have any mass in the source area or back diffusion from a clay layer? Did you check those things? Maybe that's holding up the plume. And indeed, that is exactly what was undertaken. So we came to the conclusion that this plume was being held up by something that wasn't previously accounted for. And we returned to the source area to see if we could find the smoking gun or whatever was causing our headaches out there. So we did a high-resolution study. It's a bit of a generic term, but we went out with a geoprobe rig and a macro core, and we drilled about 77 locations across the source area. We took visual logs all the way down to the top of the underlying aquitard. Scanned them with a PID, looked at them visually, smelled them, not with our nose, but with whatever we could do that was within the health and safety plan, and just wanted to see, you know, what's out there. Did we miss something? And sure enough, we did find evidence of previously unknown or unsuspected source materials. And when we found it, it wasn't in, we weren't pulling out quarts of motor oil. Instead, we just found these thin black laminae within the sand strata. And when we tested those, you know, we found high organic detections within those. So the very thin laminae is all it took to support that dissolved plume over time. And if you ever use, there's another useful model out there. If folks haven't heard of it, I'll mention it's called Source DK, Source DK, Delta Kilo. And what that model does is that just uses sort of a black box pore flush model where you put in your very characteristics. And then it'll just turn over the pore flushes and use just straight dissolution to remove the mass and nothing else. And so using source DK, you can see how recalcitrant some residual NAPLs can be and that they just persist for a long, long time. So we found out that, yeah, without attacking that source mass, then our remedial action objective of 5 parts per billion within 30 years was just not going to be a reality. One of our highest concentrations out here was 29 parts per million, and that's actually in this lower blue, we need to make that arrow flash in some way or another. This lower plume down here, oh, thank you, is where we're seeing that 29 parts per million. So the decision was to, okay, we got to attack the source. So we went out with the Dover, they have PCEs kind of a problem. They've had it in multiple areas out there, and they've found an amendment, a substrate, that if they inject it, it does a good job at giving the microbes a kick in the tail to get active. It's an organic carbon-based substrate that helps with anaerobic, I can't remember the exact name, advanced anaerobic biodegradation or something, but they come out with a geoprobe and pump this down in the source area, and that's, they pumped it this dark sort of emerald green were the treatment zones that they used for this amendment, and they went after the sources with this. And if we look at what the results were, it looked good. So the injection happened about here, and these are a couple months apart. So a couple months later, this point is right next to that, is right in the M11 area I just showed on the previous slide in the heart of the plume. After a couple of months, when things got active, it absorbed them, populations took off, we began to see a rapid decline in concentrations at that time. So it looked good. And I don't have a slide to show, but what we did, or what was done, I'm not going to take credit, was they did regression studies of these later curves downward. And doing regression, they found that in about 12 to 15 years in round numbers, we're probably going to have a lot of the mass in the source area gone. So in 12 to 15 years, there will be no mass in the source area. And at that time, the clock can start for, say, a plume, a simulation of, okay, well, now assuming there's no mass in the source area, what do you think your time would be? And so we took the next step forward with this new updated model information. We then returned to the modeling bench And we updated our model. So at this point, we pulled all the information we could from the site. We got, since we did some of the initial modeling, some additional RT3D modeling, that's the reactive transport 3D code, and non-reactive mass transport 3D multi-species were used to take another crack at this problem. And this was done, actually, because now we're helping at this point with the site managers. Now the site managers are saying, okay, we've treated this. I've got a budget in front of me. I need to know what to expect going forward. I need to know how to fund this remediation, and I need to know when it's going to be done, and we need to update the ROD to include this new information. So at this point, we're now out of the validation stage and back in the prediction stage, and the prediction stage here is helping those folks, the managers, project managers, regulators, everyone get a sort of a feel for, okay, what to expect going forward so we can get this all written out and make sure that we're good with it. So we came up and did another model with this updated information. And the output of that model, it's not graphical. Sometimes you don't have to look at model output in map views. If there's a regulator out there that's tired of getting plume maps and says, yeah, I'm sick of looking at these plume maps. They're hard to read. They're distant. You know, they're not very good for what I need to know. You can also output data in these very handy charts. You just select the cell and you say, you know, data output, select your data set, and you can create these very nice charts that are a little bit easier to look at for these purposes. And what we see is PCE and TCE in blue and red, respectively. And then we see the middle of the plume here, and then we see the far end of the plume down here. And down at the far end of the plume, it looks like we're going to be below our remedial action objectives in, I'm going to say, 15 to 20 years. I'm not going to, you know, I'll go high on this and just say, okay, there's enough air that we're probably about 20 years out, that once the source area is gone, and that's 12 to 15 years, then an additional 20 years, the body of the plume, the dissolved plume, should then also be dispersed or decayed and gone. And so therefore, we're looking about a total of, let's say, again, 40 years, rounding up for a little bit of safety. So for 40 years, we should write into the budget, we need to monitor, do additional amendments as needed, and then write that into the ROD that that's our new remedial action objective. And indeed, that's just what was done. The ROD was updated to include the addition of these substrates to help the bacteria attack the local microorganisms attack the source mass in the source area. And then, so again, in summary, it's not a very long presentation. We just thought it'd be interesting to say, show how a case study works where, you know, modeling is in there. It's a tool. It's not the answer. We had this area that's been going, we've been working at for 30 years, and we continue to, you know, pull the models out, pull the data out, and continue to, you know, to recheck ourselves. Hey, is it going the way we think it should? Do we need to look at something different? When do we need to look at something different? The subsequent source areas, we found the source areas, we treat them, and then we refine the updated model. So now we can, again, help the site managers, both the private and the base managers, more effectively manage their sites in a cost-efficient and also a realistic manner of what they can expect to happen next. And a path forward, this is something we always like to include, is just like, okay, well, where are we going? We're going to, of course, continue the annual plume monitoring and evaluation of the constant trends to make sure that they're online. Year to year is probably a bit too close, but every 2 to 5 years, you can stop and take a look back. It's a good length of interval to let time pass so you get past some of the local variation. You can start looking for trends. Something we always need to continue doing is, you know, right now the more work that's going on is in stratigraphy, is we're finding out more and more that, you know, stratigraphy mass movement isn't bulk flow through a wholly uniform media, that you have gravel trains where most of your mass is going, or most of your advection is happening, and then you have a lot of mass storage in the finer textures, almost like a dual mode model, a fracture mode and a matrix mode, where you have a lot of groundwater movement, but not so much mass movement through the fractures, and a lot of mass storage happening in the finer grain. So we should always continue to look at that to make sure that we've actually captured at the scale and at the material necessary to understand the processes. Some processes happen on several centimeters, some processes happen across several feet. Are we looking in the right scale at our problem? And that's just something we continue to evaluate going as a matter of course. And then once we have RAOs, we want to make sure that, you know, we're going to stay at them and we're not going to have a back diffusion issue or something else that's going to continue to cause our mass to rebound in some way and then push us back over the RAOs. So once we're done, we're still not done. We have to continue making sure that things are happening what's happening, and we're not going to be surprised by something as we have been before. And with that, that's really all. That's our talk right there. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you, Scott. I want to remind folks that are listening, you can go ahead and write your questions for our speakers down in the Q&A pod in your lower right corner of your screen there. And if you've expanded the screen so you don't see that box anymore, just hover over the top, and that toolbar should come back up so you can press the little exploding arrow icon to bring that back up. Scott, let me just ask you the same question that we asked Noman earlier. So when you're creating a model, how do you convince your client or your shareholder that they should be putting in the extra money so that you can put in the time and effort to do your calibration, validation, and sensitivity analysis?
You get with your regulator and tell them to make the client do it. So I say, hey, Noman, would you tell the client to make sure that this happens? That's a good question. I mean, it's sort of, there's always time to do it wrong. There's never time to do it over. Is that the saying? It's always time to do it fast, never time to do it over, or something like that. But basically, it's the model itself, in my experience, and I don't know if this is diverging from your question a little bit, the model itself, especially when you're talking to clients and sort of more lay people, is they have an idea of, oh, it's the answer. You know, we're going to do a model and get the answer. And that's not the case at all. It's like managing expectations of what comes out of a model with a client is, and anybody, the public or elsewhere, is such a hard thing to do because, a computer, nowadays computer graphics can be so convincing. Oh, it's a perfect picture. It shows I've got my preconceived notion, and this picture here is right in line with what my preconceived notion is. And it's just so easy for people to lose track of, you know, this is only doing things that we're telling it to do. And yet it's back to, you know, if your model is so good, don't be afraid to go test it by taking a sample. You know, if you say that, oh, my model says the plume's not going to go off past the fence line, okay, let's go to the fence line and take some samples. And then, or if they think a model's going to show that they're not going to exceed something, then don't be afraid to say, well, maybe we should go double check our input values on XYZ because they are very sensitive. And if we're off by a certain amount, we can run that number up or down and start saying, hey, you know, that's a problem. So I think managing expectations on the very front end is probably the key to how the model is perceived on the back end. And it's never really the answer. It's part of the answer. It's a tool. It's what you help as a modeler, the site scientist, use so he or she can understand their site better, not as the single answer that, well, the model says that therefore it's right. So it's really the site scientist who should be driving. The modeler should be helping them, not leading them. But a lot of cats in that bag, but that's my thoughts on that.
All good points. So. Thank you. And we had someone else ask, how are the small-scale processes simulated in your models? So, for example, will back diffusion in thin laminae show up in your models?
No, they absolutely wouldn't. And that's a problem or a situation that's really becoming, as back diffusion and diffusion in general is becoming such a, and small-scale processes are becoming such a, the forefront now that in the old days we wouldn't have any hesitance of making a model with 50-foot cells and then drawing conclusions. These small-scale features are something that, you know, to model diffusion, you almost need like a centimeter scale, at least on a finite difference grid, it's like a centimeter scale grid. And then your bulk flow water has to be something larger unless you have some crazy supercomputer you can use. So we wouldn't see that at all. I think the way we would address it is either analytically on the outside, and say, okay, well, the model's going to be a bulk flow simulation at this scale, and we know we have that phenomenon happening, so we're going to calculate that externally using an external model and then take that data and, if we're going to see it at all, put it into the model as a source term of some kind or another. But at least insofar as ModFlow MT3D, RT3D world goes, and I don't know that I'm not the end-all be-all authority on the current builds for these various things, that requires a lot of sort of turns of the screwdriver to get just right. Some of the newer models, like the USGS code, Mod USGS, I know he uses, Sonbay uses like analytical element methods within the model for a lot of the well functions. So now you actually have an analytical model sort of built within a numerical model, which is kind of cool. But to answer that question, no, this model would certainly miss it. We'd have to do that work externally.
All right. Well, thank you, Scott. I think at this time we're going to move on to our third speaker. Thanks again for your presentation. So lastly, we'll have John Fenske today. He's a senior hydraulic engineer with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in the Institute for Water Resources Hydrologic Engineering Center, which is located in Davis, California. Mr. Fenske has over 29 years of professional experience in the field of groundwater hydrology. At HEC, his work focuses on numerical modeling of groundwater flow, interaction between groundwater and surface water, subsurface investigative methods, and contaminant transport. Mr. Fenske has assisted in groundwater investigation and modeling projects in Kenya, Ethiopia, Mongolia, Vietnam, and Cambodia. At HEC, Mr. Fenske is tasked with providing a robust groundwater capability to the HEC surface water models, HEC RAS and HEC HMS, and for 2 years he was an environmental engineer with the US EPA in Dallas, Texas. His tasks focus on groundwater hydrology, contaminant transport, and remediation. John, I think I hear you on the line. You can go ahead and take it away.
So can you hear me okay?
I can.
Great. You cannot, or you can? Hopefully
I
guess you can.
I can hear you.
Anyway, thanks, Cynthia. Anyway, just one comment from what Scott mentioned about he referred to the importance of having regulators on board as far as wanting funding to help validate and get more calibration and everything that you want for the model and data gathering. And the project I want to talk about today has to do with the Tooele Army Depot in Utah. And we were fortunate to have the regulatory agency, the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, require us to do a annual update to the model, which included data gathering, recalibration, and also additions of contaminant transport, stochastic analysis, all these different things. And so that was a real key. I wanted to say that right from the beginning. I've worked on this project for most of these years with Pete Anderson over at Tetra Tech in Georgia and Dr. James Ross, who's at Hydrogeologic in Ohio, and it's been a real pleasure working with them. Do you know what? I can't find my little arrow to go to the next page. Cynthia?
You should see it down at the bottom of the screen, so you might need a mouse over it.
The screen looks a little different. I apologize, everybody. Let me try reopening the
I can go ahead.
The meeting room? Maybe doing it. Okay. Did you just do that?
Yeah.
Okay. I just reopened the thank you for your patience. I just did open another meeting room. Hopefully that'll have it.
Okay.
Maybe I made a mistake on clicking on something.
Okay.
So I'll be right with you. Anyway, I still don't have. I'll go to full screen. That might make a difference.
Oh, let's see. I see you in here.
I just closed that one. I went to full screen, but I still don't have any buttons to click on.
How about now?
Yes, everything's working great. Okay, thank you. Anyway, so the Tooele Army Depot, and I have the pointers here. The Tooele Army Depot is located in northwest Utah. At one time, it was the largest pump and treat system in the Department of Defense. And it's typical, the basin and range province in this area. You can see it's near Salt Lake City and the Great Salt Lake. And the hydrology of the system is basically you have most of your precipitation occurring in the mountains and then recharging as snowmelt into the basins below. Here's a view from the satellite. Here's the location of the Tooele Army Depot here. Here's the Ochre Mountains here where the water discharges from the mountain fronts into the system. Here's a picture I took from a plane flying into Salt Lake City, and here's the location of the depot on the Ochre Mountains too, just to kind of give you some different kind of overview of the site. Here's a ground level. You can see the Great Salt Lake in the distance. Here's the industrial area of the Tooele Army Depot here. So between World War II and Vietnam, there's a lot of work on the industrial area here where they used it to maintain military vehicles. And so they used the solvent TCE, which is a very common contaminant in all this work. And the discharge of the solvent went into unlined waste dishes, into these dishes into a lagoon. And this was common back then. They didn't quite have the environmental regulations at the time. The main sources of contamination are from this building here called Building 679, also Building 615 located right here. Here's Building 679. It's the location of a lot of the maintenance activities that resulted in contamination. So, I can put this up here. So the Tooele Army Depot, had contamination starting in 1942, primarily TCE, multiple sources, and it resulted in 4-mile-long plumes extending offside of the depot. The big concern of the regulators is this plume reaching, going beyond this management action boundary and potentially affecting municipal wells, agricultural wells, these kind of things. The remedial activities over the past years included excavation and tapping. We had a 5,400 gallon per minute pump and treat system operating for 10 years from 94 to 2004. This is the largest in the DOD where we use air stripping. So basically, we pump the water out, went to this air stripping mechanism where we basically took the TC from the ground and put it in the air and then re-injected it into the surface. Source treatment, and currently we're doing this currently also, and also monitor national attenuation. Luckily, the regulatory requirements required a monitoring computer characterization and annual updates to the flow and transport model. And this is a unique case. So we had a consistent modeling team over the past 25 years, and this groundwater model was required to be updated annually. And so some of the applications we did over these years is defining sensitive parameters, data gathering, to help improve the conceptual model. We use it for support of the shutdown of the pump and treat system, which is very expensive to operate. And so the model is used to help provide evidence to support that shutdown, which the regulators accepted, and that we could enable the implementation of MNA. The application provided supporting evidence for abiotic degradation, and also we used modeling to do a probabilistic analysis of plume migration reaching the action boundaries. Here's the modeling team. I'm on the left. You can see it's cold and snowy, but nothing prevented us from doing our assigned tasks. And it's a real pleasure working with these people. Here we are standing on one of the key features at the modeling site. Here's an overview of the different modeling reports starting in 1993 all the way up to, I think this serves 2013, but we've gone all the way up to 2019, which just submitted. So it's been going on for a while. And the most significant model changes over this period is the initial flow model that I did at AGC, and we did a lot of annual recalibrations. Then the flow and transport model was introduced in 2004 with the assistance of a GeoTrans at the time, later Tetra Tech. And we did transient calibrations to water levels from 1942 to present. We introduced uncertainty in the model presentations. We used PEST, parameter estimation tool, and we also used an evaluation using ensemble common filtering. And just recently, we did an initial implementation of abiotic degradation to the modeling system. So over time, you can see as we have more data, that justifies we have a better understanding of the site and site hydrology, and that would justify a greater complexity of the model, more, I guess, cells and more refined delineation, just cell spacing reducing over time, the number of layers increasing over time, the size of the model domain increasing over time. and the total number of cells. And this is basically just a function you could see over time that as you have more data, a greater understanding of the system, this allows for a more refined approach to the modeling. Here's the source flux by area. We could see starting in 2003, it was dominated by Building 679 and the landfill area. And it became refined over time as we received more information. And then in 2013, by the way, this is World War II to Vietnam, so you can see this big drop in you can see the big increase here, the drop in the Vietnam period. And then here we have the Building 615 was identified as a larger source, this purple area, as a larger source in 2013 than previously thought. So you can see that the source, as we got more information, was refined through time. So the use of the model I want to talk about today is a couple of which I thought to be the most interesting cases. Is, first of all, in the conceptual model development, looking at the mountain front recharge to groundwater, kind of reevaluating the data and learning more about the conceptualization of the system. Also, this location of this confining bed, which is one of the controlling features of the site. Furthermore, another one we want to talk about is how the model was used as supporting evidence for abiotic degradation and actually helped support the physical investigation of degradation on the site. And also the use of the model as a planning lead time for potential remediation for the regulators using probabilistic analysis of plume migration. So as far as the mountain front recharge, as I stated earlier, most of the water from the site comes from the mountain front, snow melt in the mountains, the Basin Range. And an interesting case happened in 2016 where we had a large, fairly large snow event. Now this is in the city of Tooele, so when you go up to the Ochre Mountains above Tooele, that go up to 10,000 feet from the valley floor, which is around 4,500 feet, you're going to get much more snowfall. So we had a significant snowfall in late March of 2016, followed by warm weather. And that was an interesting case. And what was interesting is we have these different transducers located in the mountain front. The mountain fronts are basically over here, and the water flows into this. And we have these different transducers located here with continuous data. In the past, the assumption was it always took months or years for water to flow from the mountain front into the site. But we noticed from the transducers that there's a sudden, coinciding with this precipitation snowmelt event, there's a fairly abrupt 2-foot rise in water levels at the same time, located at all these wells, 1 to 2 feet, but significant water levels, abrupt water levels located at all these wells immediately adjacent to the mountain front. And if I could show in the next slide, when you go below, further away from the mountain front, below this fault where we have a sharp drop in groundwater levels, you'll notice that high abrupt change did not occur. And so I looked at this data, and first of all, I calculated the amount of this rise, this kind of abrupt immediate rise, to range from 1 to 2 feet, basically. And early water level, April water level spike in water levels. And I did some investigation into the data. Well, here's a satellite view. So we have these different canyons from the Ochre Mountains that are immediately up gradient of where the well locations are here. And any kind of snow melt would immediately go into the canyons and go into the subsurface here. Like I said previously, excuse me, we assume that this would be take months or years, but the evidence seems to indicate otherwise. So I did some literature search, and Gregory Carling from BYU in 2007 did this analysis of mountain front recharge in the Basin Range in an area pretty close to where the Tooele Valley is. It's in the Basin Range, and he noted that there is a fairly immediate response to groundwater levels from mountain front recharge events in the Basin and Range. And that kind of changed our whole conceptualization of the system, because that's a key source of water flowing through the system. So the conclusions from that is, excuse me, the southeast wells close to the mountain front had the greatest early April response and model levels, depth of snowmelt and subsequent increase in groundwater recharge from canyons and streams was larger and faster than expected. This is contrary to our previous conceptualization. So I put that in the actual model. And in the previous models for this stress period, I had a lower boundary condition as the boundary conditions fluctuate seasonally and through the years. And I increased that 4 feet to simulate a more immediate change in water levels in the groundwater resulting from spring discharge, or not spring, from snowmelt discharge from the mountains for that one specific time period. And the initial calibration of the model, which was like this, suddenly became much improved, as you can see there. So that's basically using field data to help improve the conceptualization of the system. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Another thing I want to talk about is this confining bed, which is located right here in the model domain. And this is the confining bed here. And this is an important controlling feature because water tends to go below the confining bed and discharge of springs. And this separates a lot of the agriculture wells and areas of concern from the plume, which is located right in this area. So over the years, we located this, let me go back to this, we located this confining bed through a hydrogeologic approach based on water levels, pump test data, these kind of things, or pumping data. And this was location just based upon that boring logs to a lesser extent. And so this was, we located this hydrogeologically. And many years later, like a few years ago, we came across a study by the Utah Geologic Survey, which did a water bounce survey of the Tooele Valley. Of course, we should have probably found this information earlier. But the interesting thing about this water bounce survey, is they had the same conceptualization where you have the mountain front recharge coming in and recharging the groundwater system. And then there's a upward flow. You can see there's a downward flow, a recharge flow, then a discharge upland flow where you have wetlands and mudflats. And here again, we have the recharge area and a discharge area where you have wetlands. And this is all from Utah Geologic Survey. Here's a picture of the springs that are located in the Tooele Valley at the discharge areas. So the real interesting thing on this is you'll notice that this red line indicates our location of the confining bed in the model using a hydrogeologic approach. And this dashing line comes from the Utah Geologic Survey. And this is where they located their confining bed, where it intersects with the water table, basically. And so we were all excited about that because basically this kind of provides evidence, even validation from an independent data source that our assumptions and our conceptual model development regarding this was more accurate. We always thought it was accurate, but this gave further credence and further reliability to this conceptualization. Another thing I'd like to talk about is using the model for supporting evidence for degradation. Let's take a look at the model plume. Here's a couple sources here from the industrial area and a new source that was later discovered. And you can see over time that you can see the model grow over time to current conditions. Here's the model plume in 2017. Here's the measured plume using Krieging in late 2017 in the same time period. And you'll notice that the model plume extends significantly further at both of these lobes than does the Krieg plume. So, and I was responsible for the flow system in this modeling effort. And you'll notice that we have a good match with the gradients in this area. This is a great match, but you'll notice that the concentration matches the same too well. The model is over-simulating concentrations in this well D9 and this well D22. And so you would think that we have the flow model accurately simulating the system, but the contaminant transport model is over-simulating the contamination. And so the only way we could actually get an accurate representation of this contaminant level is by introducing some sort of other process into the system. And that led some credence to the idea of degradation, abiotic degradation. So that supported the need for some kind of investigation into the field evidence about this over-simulation of historical and future plume movement. And so if you can kind of read through that. And so the model, from this model, it's supporting physical evidence. We recommend that we get supporting physical evidence for degradation. As you can see from this figure here by the EPA, there's a relationship between magnetic susceptibility and first order degradation. And so the higher the magnetic susceptibility of the soil, the higher the degradation constant. And so some physical studies were undertook where borings were drilled into the at the well site, at the modeling site, and the samples were taken to Savannah and analyzed for magnetite. And here's a picture of one of the samples. You can see there's magnetite in the sample. And this study was performed by John Wilson, who I believe used to work for the EPA also. And you can see that there's a relationship in the samples taken from the field data and degradation and the magnetic susceptibility. So that suggested abiotic degradation of TCE, and that's the first line of evidence of the TCE degradation. There's a broad range, but it's also defined spatially variable via the hydrogeologic zonations. So let's take a look. So that gave us physical evidence to support the degradation occurring. And so that was put into the transport model. And here's the plume without the degradation. And here's the updated model plume with degradation. And this is a much better match with the actual physical measurements, which are, you can kind of see in the small little circles of yellow. That's 5 to 30 parts per billion TCE. And so that was interesting. That's another application of the model, basically providing support for the physical investigation of degradation. Another thing I'd like to talk about is how the model is used as a planning lead time for potential remediation. One of the key questions that the regulators want to know is how long are TC concentrations likely to remain below 5 parts per billion along the groundwater management area or 1 mile buffer boundary? This will give the regulators time in case they need to do some kind of remediation efforts. So the first thing was to do was to initialize the predictive plume reflecting both modeled and observed TC concentration. So we're trying to get the best location of the initial plume, and then employing the Monte Carlo analysis, which introduced some stochasticity into the modeling system and allowed for us to kind of get an idea of the uncertainty going forward as far as the plume migration. So here's kind of a five-year prediction using the Monte Carlo analysis and uncertainty analysis. Here's our initial location of the plume. And after 5 years, you can see it migrated about 1,900 feet in this direction at this area of the plume and 1,600 feet in this area of the plume. And you'll notice that here's the one-mile boundary, which is a boundary of key interest to regulators. And so by using the stochastic approach, we were able to come up with this uncertainty analysis that provided pretty good assurance to the regulators that within 6 years, if you look at this probabilistic analysis, there's a 100% chance that the plume will not reach the action boundary within the next 6 years. And actually within 12 years, which is the blue line, you can see there's about an 82% chance that the plume will stay within a 1 mile boundary. So this graph right here is the bottom line brought that was given to the regulators. This is their area of most concern, and this is the culmination of all the work of this one graph. So in conclusion, I think I'm going a little faster. I thought I had it's going to take longer, so I sped up a little bit more than I should have. In conclusion, the TWILA model has been continuously developed and refined on an annual basis over a 25-year period. The groundwater flow and transport modeling team has been largely consistent through these times. This has allowed for multiple field investigations, the increased complexity and expanse of the model as the data warrants, validation of the model based on studies independent from the modeling effort. I thought that was really interesting. Developing supporting evidence for abiotic degradation and planning lead time for potential remediation in the future. And that's all I have. I don't know if there's any questions, Cynthia.
Okay, thank you, John. Let's see. I just want to remind folks to go ahead and put your questions into that Q&A box down on the lower right. We'll give it just a minute and see if some more come in. Well, John, I suppose you are also in the position to tell folks that they need to do their calibration and validation and sensitivity analysis. So do you have any other comments to add about that?
Well, yeah, that's a required. That should be a required step in any kind of model development, of course. And as Scott mentioned, it's really important to make sure that the client or regulators understand the importance of that. And I think this model helped demonstrate the usefulness of modeling. To close down the pump and treat system, was the cost of the remediation activities was much, much greater, exponentially greater, than the cost of modeling. And so if the model could be used as a tool, which basically, you know, a model basically gives the best guess you can, you know, given data limitations as a particular tool of the system, it could be used as a tool for regulators to present to regulators to help in some of these cost-saving measures, such as shutting down the pump and treat system and going to M&A. And the really cool thing about this is this, over the years, we've seen it develop and we've learned new things. And we've seen independent validation from independent studies. And it's kind of a rare case because it's the only one that I've been on that I've been allowed to stay with for such a long period of time.
Right, so you had time to go back and look at things more.
In retrospect, see how well you're doing and correct things as you go. Yeah.
Great, thank you. So I have one question that came in for Noman earlier, so I want to see if Noman, you're there, if I can get you to answer this. But thank you, John.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, great, okay. So this person asked, in order to get a better calibration for the transport part of your model, is it okay to sacrifice the calibration of the flow part of the model?
Actually, I would say no, because you have a better control on the flow model as far as the data. You have more dense data and more data availability for your flow model calibration. At the same time, you have much fewer number of parameters to calibrate in flow model. So I would stick to my flow model and then play with the transport model parameters. Don't want to mess up. So if I want to get a better calibration on transport model, then sacrifice my calibration on the flow model, I would not go there. Again, any calibration is a non-unique solution, so you can find a different set of calibration parameter for the transport model given the flow model or keeping the flow model same.
Great, thank you. Scott and John, anything to add to that, or do you agree?
I agree with Noman. No, you don't want to do that. And a technical reason aside, there's also the political reason, is that when you start doing that, it gets real hard to explain your model to someone and say, well, I slowed down the water to take advantage of that so I could increase the degradation rate. And once you go down that sort of arm-waving exercise to explain your model, that's when you get a lot of regulators raising an eyebrow at you saying, what the heck are you trying to pull on me here, pal? I think you really want to – they're in balance, and you got to make that balance work one way or the other. And sometimes maybe you can't do it, you say you can't do it. But if you start sort of bending the rules a little bit like that, then it gets real hard to explain your model to someone else.
Yeah, this is John. Yeah, the flow model is really the foundation of that which everything else is built upon. And so – you can't sacrifice that. And you can see in our study at Tooele, we had a good match of water levels and flows with the flow model, and we were over-predicting the transport model. And we just basically just said that to the regulators, saying, you know, here's the flow model, and the transport model is showing over, you know, showing excessive migration. And that led to the investigation of degradation. but we would never sacrifice the flow model, because that, as Noman said, that's the foundation, that's the basis, that's the easiest to calibrate, that's the basis of your conceptualization of the system. So that should be the that should be the foundation, I guess, that everything is built upon.
Good points, all of them. Okay, thank you guys. At this point, I think we are ready to close out this webinar. I want to thank our speakers one more time, and I just want to give folks a heads up on the other part of this this series. So this was the second of a two-part series on modeling and supportive site remediation. So if you missed our session last week, let me just give you some information on how to find it. So last week, we had a webinar with Alan Shapiro of USGS, Sophia Lee of NAVFAC, and Haruko Wainwright of Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. And that session is recorded and available on CLUIN. You can go to this link here, or you can go back to the seminar homepage and you can find links to get over to that one. You can also check out frtr.gov for upcoming Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable meetings and webinars that will be hosted here on CLUIN. We should have another webinar series coming up soon in early 2020. Please feel free to connect with CLUIN using social and professional network sites. You'll find CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. You can sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, to learn about new webinars and resources related to hazardous waste site cleanup. Thank you again for joining today's live webinar. I'd like to remind our participants that slides and other items related to this session can be found on the seminar resources page. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. You'll also find information for our speakers and organizers on the presenters page, as we noted earlier. I'd like to ask you to take a brief moment to fill out that online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's session, both the content covered and the method of delivery. Although we don't offer PDHs or CEUs for our webinars, you can save or print a webinar participation certificate after you submitted feedback for today's event. Be sure that you check the bottom the box at the bottom of the feedback form to certify that you were here for the entire event or that you replayed the complete archive. If you don't check the box, you don't get a certificate. You can find, you might find that a copy of your registration email and the seminar slides and the confirmation email are enough to document your participation in today's event with your own accrediting institution for PDHs or CEUs. And if you participated as part of a group, each person can fill out that online feedback form to get their own certificate. This applies to those watching the recorded version as well. And we do look at your comments on these as we continue to try and improve the content and delivery mechanisms. So please feel free to fill those out. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation. Lastly, today's session was recorded. In the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today as part of the archive. You will automatically receive an email once that archive is available. That's the end of our final reminders. Thank you for joining us on today's session. I hope you found this a valuable expenditure of your time and that we'll see you on a future webinar. This is the formal conclusion of today's broadcast.